those days when you don't feel good and everything looks so sad. When you get up from your bed, isn't your left foot not glowing? What to do with your life? So you turn on the radio, looking for music. But you can only hear waste, waste. Only waste. Then you return to bed and decide to pay a visit for the places you've never seen before. And so you walk. So, walk and walk and walk and walk. When you look around, you're in a place you've never seen before. Hearing the sound. What makes you think you are in heaven? In heaven. And so you ask. Ask I answer, brothers. And so you ask me. What does it mean?
Don't you know?
What is this? Is this the title of the song? It's Sergio Mendez. That's the answer to the question, what is this? It's Friday, December the 7th, and time to catch up with a few stories. Of course, this is Lead Stories, and I'm Eutrice Lead. Let's see, we have quite a few things brewing, and first among them, I want to just make a note. There's got to be some kind of a jinx on that congressional race to replace Jesse Jackson Jr. The latest is one of the candidates who is a state legislator in the state house of Illinois was busted at the airport and on Thursday was released on bond following his arrest on a gun charge. And what was the charge? Seems as though he said he didn't know that he was carrying a Beretta in his carry-on luggage as he attempted to board a plane. Well, that's going to cost him, in fact, it cost him $25,000 in bail money. And I'm cracking up because, I mean, what else? What's going on here in this district? First, we had Jesse Jackson, of course, quitting. Jesse Jackson Jr., sorry, quitting. And he's under the warm lights of a federal investigation. And he also is coping, he says, with a bipolar disorder. But in any event, he's out. And then we had the story of the other official who is running, who was actually convicted of raping and sexually assaulting a minor. And now comes this candidate who is up on a gun charge, and he is an elected official in the state of Illinois. Well, it must be the case that that's a requirement. You got to be indicted. Or you got to have some kind of a criminal past in order to qualify as a candidate. But it tells you that, I mean, there's got to be a point at which people say, look, enough of this stuff. This is really not what we are supposed to have in the way of representation. Governor Christie yesterday vetoed a bill that would have created this new fangled thing called the Health Insurance Exchange, which is part of the healthcare Obamacare package. And he says that he wouldn't sign it, and he decided to oppose it because, he says, the federal government cannot tell us what it will cost, how that cost compares to other options, and how much control they will give the states over this option that comes at the cost of our state's taxpayers. Now, you got to admire a person who, at the same time, you know, people got angry with him as a Republican for being so effusive in his praise of President Obama after Hurricane Sandy hit his state and carried out such an awful devastation on the coastline of New Jersey. But at the same time, he's right on track. He's saying, I'm responding now as a Republican governor, and I do not like this Obamacare, which the Republican Party itself rejects. And that's a very interesting story, because I think, and as I've said here too, this Obamacare package really is an articulation of the Clinton era, and there are fundamental questions about it that should be asked and answered. But it seems that that is not going to be part of what President Obama wants to do. What he wants to do is to just, you know, continue doing what he wants to do. And that is to simply carry out the unfinished business of the Clinton era. It's a huge thing, this healthcare package. Even experts at healthcare say it's so complicated. But what they are very clear about is that the primary beneficiaries of this new system that the president wants enacted is that it will enrich the insurance companies. And it certainly will enrich the pharmaceutical companies. But we can't seem to get a public explanation of how this works, not from the administration. And frankly, I don't think that many people in Congress really understand what it is. So they have not explained it to their constituents. All I have seen were the pieces of emailed literature that were coming at me fast and furiously when in the heat of the election, urging that you vote Democrat because the Democrats have this great healthcare plan and you would definitely benefit from it. But if only you vote for the Democratic candidate, you will get healthcare. And that is an interesting way to go about things. But this bill needs to be completely disassembled, and it needs to be discussed. I don't get the sense that the American people fully appreciate what this calls for. Insiders probably know what it means. All of the finite details of it, they probably know what those are. It's a huge piece of legislation. And we have no discussion of it. It is absolutely amazing, absolutely amazing. Well, I see that Sister Hillary is in Ireland. This is now for the eighth time. So it probably means that, again, I always say, wherever the Clintons are, look out, there's got to be some kind of a agenda afoot. My suspicion is the agenda is to, because Bill Clinton was there not too long ago, and it means that there's an interest in Northern Ireland. So keep your eyes peeled, because you will want to know what that interest is, and it will make itself known, because that's the way they operate. It is no accident that Mrs. Clinton has gone there 8 times already, and this time, of course, she's behaved like the typical ugly American tourist. By inserting herself in the affairs of the country, castigating people for their political differences and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, in the world of diplomacy, you ought to know how to behave when you visit somebody else's country. No country is perfect, but certainly when you go to visit as a diplomat, you behave diplomatically. You don't get involved in people's internal affairs. You leave that to the governments and their representatives so that they can handle their own affairs. You just, you know, shake hands, be nice, and do all that you need to do to be gracious, and then you make your exit. but you certainly don't go around telling people. You know, it's like Netanyahu and how he behaved when he was in the United States for the General Assembly meeting and decided that he can just insert himself in the most repugnant way in the internal affairs of the United States. It is, in the world of diplomacy, it is a capital offense to do something like that. You just don't do that at all. We see that the presidential election broke the $2 billion milestone. And that's from the official filings of the Democratic and Republican parties. Now, that says something in a country that is hurting so badly for money, that the election would cost that much, and that that kind of money is so easily available, but money to do essential things like, you know, help build or rebuild neighborhoods that are devastated by the storm, help end hunger, help build schools, and help to furnish indigent people with the kinds of support and assistance that they need. That money can't be available. But to run an election, and it costs in excess of $2 billion, it is an unbelievable statement of insanity. This is where America is at. You know, you have the money, you could be anything. All it requires is that you just have to have the money. You can buy anything you wish. You can buy, you can make the company and people love you. You can make your questionable past become pristine and clean. You can do a whole lot of things when you have $2 billion to do it. And that's exactly where it is. So, $2 billion. The next time we read about the next presidential race, it would probably be by then about $2.5 billion to run for office in the United States. What a thing. What a thing. Your calls at 1-888-874-4888. I want to say something very, very clear about the Federal Reserve. But we'll talk with you first, and I'll end with that segment today. 1-888-874-4888 is the number to call. And let's get a conversation going. This is your program as well, so I want you to be the featured guests today as well. We'll take this break and come back to your calls.
In a place you've never seen before. Hearing the sound. Who makes you think you were in heaven?
Oh, we're back. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And Sarah from Dallas, you're up first.
Greetings to you, Latrice. Oh, you okay. Excuse me.
You're on.
Yes, greetings to you. I had my time mixed up.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay, I'm on the Central Time, and I was looking. I kept saying, well, why am I not getting the live show? And I realized that you come in on the Eastern time, so since I'm 1 hour behind, I had to make sure I adjusted it so today I could get the live
report. I'm glad. So what's your comment today?
I have a couple of things I would like to touch on briefly with you, Eutrice. One of them had to do with I re-listened to some of your podcasts from last week and got caught up with this week's. And you were speaking with Clinton and this AIDS initiative. And one thing, one guest I would like for you to, if perhaps you can get in contact with her and get her on your show. Her name is Dr. Nancy Turner-Banks. I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
No.
Okay, Dr. Turner-Banks, she's a retired gynecologist, epidemiologist, and she would be able to give you more clarification on this AIDS scam that's being pushed around the globe, funneled by, of course, the Clinton Global Initiative, as well as the Bill Gates Foundation.
There's a lot of information out there to the contrary, which is why, you know, I talked about the move by Mrs. Clinton, mm-hmm. Basically picking up the Bush administration program and appearing to suggest that this was, you know, something entirely new, but you know, it was under Bush. But fine. Let's talk about what is it that you want to talk about that is relevant to our programming today?
What I wanted to speak on today is you covered a lot of it with this, especially with the Clintons, and I was so glad that you were pounding on them, because I've been pounding on them trying to get black people out of this foolishness of looking at Clinton as so-called being this savior, because I look at them as being the most destructive thing that have happened to the black after Lyndon Johnson. The Clintons were the next destructive Democratic presidency in modern times that have totally destroyed the black community. Because you're coming up from the New York City area, and you know for a fact that here it is, Bill Clinton, when he left office, decided that he was going to put his office in Harlem. Now, the minute he moved into Harlem, the regentrification came in right on, was already started, but it tripled up under his approach when he moved into Harlem. Black people were totally displaced out of there. The rent on everything went sky high, and then all of a sudden he decided, oh, I'm going to move my office to downtown Manhattan now. Now that he has decimated the Harlem area. And black people could not for the life of them see that the destruction of the Clintons when they came up in there. The prison population skyrocketed for black people. The welfare reform that was changed to make it okay that you could not get any sort of assistance. Now, the housing, you cannot see public housing, all of those public housing that he had in all of these areas. It is totally gone. I came from Atlanta. We moved up here to Dallas within the past year. There's no public housing in Atlanta. Knocked theirs down for the Olympics when the Olympics came through in 96. All over the United States, they have gotten rid of all of the housing. So right now, as this clip that's about to come here, where black people's going to be thrown off without a safety net, a bungee cord or whatever, they're going to be falling on these rocks and getting themselves cut to pieces. It's going to really hit hard, because we ran out here with this foolishness, jumped on it, as you said. We are practicing slave religion, Miss Utrice. We are doing this slave religion whereby black people are in this mode whereby we allow these white politicians to come up into your church. They tell you all of this nonsense that they tell you, because they only come around at election time in order to get you to run out there to the polls. You run out there like a chicken with the head cut off. You don't think, you don't ask for nothing, you just feel privileged because this good white man took his time to come up into your church and sat up in the front row of your church on this good Sunday, mess up the whole parking arrangements of the church, and all of a sudden you're running out there like a fool, have no agenda, didn't ask for anything. All you're concerned about is that you can show that you have this big 8x10 glossy that you could hang up on your wall to show that this so-called politician came into your office. This is a slave mentality that we are doing here.
Well, let me respond. Thanks for your comment. Let me respond to that. Number one, this is not unique to white politicians. The black politicians themselves do even worse. They do the same and worse. And they show contempt for the community. That's across the board, but it is especially foul when in a community or communities that are distressed, the leadership that you hope would be an organic leadership coming from the same communities seem to not respond in a different way. They adopt the same rapacious attitudes as across the board, and that's a fact. Clinton went to Harlem as a way of suggesting, you know, it's a good PR move, but also as a way of suggesting that Harlem needs to be looked at differently, and Harlem has possibilities, but it was a PR move, of course. But the destruction of Harlem did not come about as a result of Bill Clinton moving uptown. The destruction of Harlem was well in effect under black leadership. They were the ones who oversaw the destruction of Harlem and initiated it in some cases. So Bill is not to be blamed for that at all. But you are right on this issue of the Clintons fabricating a persona that is quite effective. In fact, and that's what I wanted to talk about today. I'll get you to that piece. A poll was conducted just recently, the way, this is how it's done when people want to test the waters, and this is how the Clintons do it. They kind of encourage polls to be taken, meaning they pay somebody to do a poll. And in any event, this poll showed Hillary Clinton as the favored candidate if she decided to run. If she decided to run in 2016, she is favored over Governor Andrew Cuomo. And here's what's interesting about that poll. The poll said that right now, New Yorkers are asked, who, you know, what are your opinions about Hillary Clinton? What are your opinions about Governor Cuomo? And they tended to be the same. The statistics were pretty much the same. 72% said they favored Andrew Cuomo, and about three quarters of the people, 75%, sorry, my math is bad, said they favored Clinton. Not too big a difference, but interesting. But when it came to president, a majority said they favored Clinton. That is 54% said they favored Clinton, as opposed to 39% who said they favored Cuomo for the White House. Here's how it broke down, because you're talking now about white politicians and black support. Clinton's support, this is the report, Clinton's support is widespread. 59% of women, 69% of liberals, 58% of moderates, 74% of black voters, and 64% of Latinos want her to run. I want to repeat that. 59% of women, 69% of liberals, 58% of moderates. Then 74% of black voters and 64% of Latinos. Understand this? This is how it goes. The idea is that people need to pay attention of the role of PR and how it is done. So this shapes the impression that very early on, because she hasn't left the administration yet, but very early on, she is a person who should be enticed to run. And look, even before she declares, look how widespread her appeal is. How about that? Support is weaker among men, 45% of whom wanted to run. Only 45% of men wanted to run. And Jewish voters, who give her a narrow plurality of 47%. So you see the lopsided nature of things. Hillary just went and personally salvaged peace in the Middle East. 47% of Jewish voters, however, said, yeah, we like her. That's interesting. David from San Francisco, you're on the air.
Hey, morning. I wanted to raise, out here in San Francisco, we've had a lot of advantages and disadvantages with people who pretend to be progressives and are actually, you know, just self-serving. And I was just going to raise the issue about, it is very important that we continually lobby these politicians to perform. We've been able to keep the Board of Supervisors in a progressive way because of continual lobbying. We make sure that we get them to perform, and if they don't, then their record is there to, as an adjunct to Election Day. You didn't perform, you're not going to get reelected. And I could go in a bunch of different directions. I don't know if you've ever heard of instant runoff voting, but
yes.
That's a very useful thing out here. Instead of voting for the top two, you know, and holding your nose and you know, voting for the lesser of two evils. Instant runoff voting means that you can rank your best choice, your second best choice, your third best choice, your fourth best choice, and when the vote tally comes in, people are always the rating comes in for who people really believe in, and it's created a lot of very unique changes in the Board of Supervisors solely because we have this instant runoff voting or ranked choice. And I very much urge progressives nationwide to try to get that going in your states, your towns, your counties, whatever, because you're going to get some changes when you get instant runoff voting. And finally, I've lost respect for the Clintons. When there was the big tsunami down in the Indian Ocean, this was probably, 7 years ago or so, Bill Clinton got together with George Bush Sr. to do a huge fundraising effort for the nations that were hard hit by that tsunami. And as I understand it, they raised about $15 billion to help out down there, and most of that money went missing. And the idea that that the presidents, you know, whether it's Bush and Clinton, in conjunction with each other, were able to raise such a massive amount of money, and what they ended up doing was kicking the poor off the beaches. If they had shoreline properties, they kicked them off, and they turned all of that land into high-dollar resorts. And so they essentially scammed the money and used political influence to steal the beachfront property. So I somewhat agree with your caller I'm not sure if is your other caller a guest or a
no, she is a caller.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I somewhat agree with her on the Clintons. I don't find that they're very honorable. There's what's called the Democratic Leadership Conference, and the DLC is something that was made up of the far right-wing Democrats probably 15 or 20 years ago when they were trying to deal with, there was the progressives, the hippies, the 60s movements trying to change the Democratic Party, and the DLC were created by Sam Nunn and Scoop Jackson and John Tower and some of the most, you know, ugly military-industrial complex corrupt types created the DLC, and Bill Clinton and, frankly, Barack Obama have. I've got a videotape of Barack Obama speaking before the DLC, talking about how he's a proud member of it, and so I don't really have a lot of respect for these guys, but it is very important to constantly lobby them, constantly make sure that you get them on record. Whether they perform or not is secondary. You get them on record saying something, and then when it comes time for elections or re-elections, you have their performance to fall back on.
Thank you very much, David, for your call today. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks. Well, you know, what is interesting here for me in this fiscal cliff business that we're dealing with now is the unspoken truth about what really matters in terms of what is driving the whole fiscal cliff in the first place. And both the Republicans and the Democrats would have you believe, and of course the president will have you believe, that the issue is about taming the deficit and cutting spending. It ain't necessarily so. It really isn't. What we have to watch is what is not being said. And what is not being said is that the president, Barack Obama, who I have said repeatedly, is carrying out a Clintonite agenda. He is locked into this Clintonite agenda. He is surrounded by Clintonites, and he has not sufficiently moved away from them to be seen, at least I think so, as an independent person. He has operated strictly within the confines of the Clinton agenda. And that also includes deficit spending, taming deficit spending. That was the theme of Bill Clinton's era. He was assured by Alan Greenspan that the United States would just slip into hell if he didn't do something right away to balance the books. But of course, by the time Clinton came into power, the books were very unbalanced. And as a president, you don't want your administration to be seen as failing to balance the books. So Clinton's entire terms in office, were dedicated to posterity. He's going to be known as the president who balanced the books. And how did he do that? He attacked all the social programs and cut. This is why I say this is a misnomer to think of him as a liberal at all, because he went for the social programs that served the needs of needy people. That's how he balanced the books. And that's why he boasts even now that he left a surplus. Well, interestingly, the surplus that he left was promptly spent by the next president, George Bush. George W. Bush just spent all of the surplus by giving it back to the rich. The role of the Federal Reserve cannot be underestimated in this whole scenario. And even though the Federal Reserve is supposed to be an independent entity, what the Federal Reserve has in the Obama administration that is common to the Federal Reserve of the Clinton administration is that the Federal Reserve, in the end, is the entity that is calling the shots as to how the country ought to balance its books. Now, the issue for the Federal Reserve chairman right now, or Ben Bernanke, is the same as the issue that was facing Alan Greenspan. They both, as Republicans, are conservative. And for them, it's not so much as the issue of balancing the budget, but it is about taking on what they believe to be these wild socialist programs. And we hear about Social Security, and we hear about Medicare and Medicaid as the three pillars of these social programs, among others, but those are the ones in particular, because they were the obsession of Alan Greenspan, and they are the obsession of Ben Bernanke. Bear in mind that the Federal Reserve chairman can make or break an administration. Why? Because the Fed controls interest rates, it controls banking. And ultimately, this group of bankers is not interested in social issues. They'll tell you right off the bat, that is a fiscal matter. And fiscal matters are for the legislators to solve. That's a legislative initiative. We are monetary. We are interested in maintaining the integrity of our currency. And of course, they did that very, very well. Because right now, there are five banks that control the wealth, the overwhelming majority of the wealth of the United States. Five. These five banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs Group, collectively, last year alone, held $8.5 trillion in assets. In 2007, they owned about 43% of the U.S. economy. What does all of this mean? From 2007 to 2011, in just that short time, the banks go from 8.5 trillion in assets to 43%. How does that happen? Well, it happens when the Federal Reserve chairman is able to persuade Congress to do its bidding. And the bailout, the bank bailout, was its bidding. So the money that should have gone into shoring up jobs and infrastructure and all these things went instead to bail out the banks, who are looked at as being too big to fail. So they subsidized the banks to make sure the banks are in good shape. And the rest is now confined to the legislature. Let them fight over how they're going to do it. Let them fight over how they're going to get the money to keep the banks okay, so that it could go another increase during this next Obama administration. So in 2007, from 43% ownership of the U.S. economy, to 2011, 56% ownership of the U.S. economy, 5 banks. So when they're talking about what has to be cut, this is why the fight has to be engaged, and this is why Obama has to be called out. Because one of the changes that should be made in this new administration is the replacement of the chairman of the Fed. The attitude has been very consistent. By the way, Bernanke didn't come in with a heap of praise or with a majority vote. He just barely got in. Even Republicans didn't like him. But the agenda remains remarkably the same, from Alan Greenspan, who served under 4 different presidents, to Ben Bernanke. It's exactly the same. And even a liberal like Bill Clinton and a liberal like Obama did exactly the same thing. They both obeyed the bidding and the fiat of the Federal Reserve. So balancing the budget, we have to see that in context. Balancing the budget has to do with the edicts of the Federal Reserve. It's as simple as that. We'll get into that in the near future, but I just wanted to plant that seed in your head so you don't get fooled by this idea that, oh, so it must be something wrong with taxes. You have to, whether it's taxes that you cut or it's social programs that you cut. No, the banks don't get cut. And what does it say about an administration that encourages this heavy-handed monopoly of the banking administrations in this country? What do you think about that? Precisely at the time that we have record unemployment, although the job picture looks good today, it looks a little better than it has in a while, the fact is the primary concern of the Obama administration is the same as it was under George Bush, and it's the same as it was under Bill Clinton. The person we really have to watch is a chairman of the Federal Reserve. And it is a chairman of the Federal Reserve that is calling the shots as to what domestic policy ought to be. Okay, so now whenever people are talking about this fiscal cliff, you shouldn't get upset about it. The political people will articulate their arguments one way or the other, and they will meet and negotiate. But both sides are taking their instruction from the Fed. Both sides agree that one thing they do not need to disturb is the five banks that own the vast percentage of our economy. They absolutely agree with that. Nobody's going to tinker with that formula. Nobody's going to ask the banks to cut their profit margins. The bailout, the entire bailout, in fact, which I said, started in the Clinton administration. The seeds were planted back then. They got their bailout under Obama. George Bush spent a surplus. Obama's job, as the Fed sees it, Obama's job is to return the banks to their dominance worldwide, but certainly in the United States in terms of ownership of the economy. It doesn't matter who is in the White House. This is the problem that we have. The Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan was like God. If he woke up in the morning with a bad attitude and he says, well, you know, it's going to be a bad day, no matter what the facts are, everybody's going to see it as a bad day. And with the blink of an eye, he changed the world and the banking industry globally. And stocks and bonds and all of that fluctuated on how Alan Greenspan was seeing the world. And he saw the world really bizarrely in many cases. The world he saw was shaped by the prism of a conservative political philosophy. And so when these folks come forward and they tell you about monetary practice, and it's the political philosophy that they have. The political philosophy is what informs their actions, no matter how much they try to distance themselves from it. Ben Bernanke is a conservative Republican. He absolutely is of the mold of Alan Greenspan. No definitive difference there. And he does not intend to move anywhere farther from Greenspan unless he wants to become more conservative than that. But he is of that mold. He came in fact, talking about the need to revamp these social programs. He sent a signal very early in the game. But Obama is carrying out the same agenda set by the same entity, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is hiding, saying that it does not meddle in political decisions, as if the economy is not a political decision. So keep that in mind, would you please? And don't get flustered about this fiscal cliff. They'll find a way to do it. Because no matter what they do to appease the public, they have to go through their thing. You know, they have to be seen as wrestling with this, and the Republicans are saying, well, this is our plan, and Barack Obama is saying, I will never sign that plan, and I will veto your plan. And they're going back and forth. They're playing the political game. But they have the same agenda in mind. They just have to make points. And the points would be whether the Republicans win the PR war or whether the president will win the PR war. But there is no difference between them at all with respect to A, who is issuing the real orders. Balancing the budget, that comes from the Fed. And ironically, the Fed is under the control of the president, but the president can't tell Bernanke what to do. Bernanke, like Alan Greenspan, is God, and he has issued his commands. And the first commandment is thou shalt rescue the banks and maintain their superiority in terms of ownership of the U.S. economy. Thou shalt not mess with the banks. Thou shalt do whatever you need to do, get the money from wherever you need to get it to balance the budget. But the banks come first. Everybody obeys that command. Well, I just wanted to say that so that it's on the record, and you will see it popping up from time to time. We'll be talking about these things, but I had to talk about it because I was waiting to see when somebody would say it, when somebody would get to that point of telling us the role of the Fed in shaping this fiscal cliff that we're supposed to be going over. And nowhere have I seen anybody say anything about this is really what the deal is. This is not a surprise. When Barack Obama came into office, it was exactly the same mandate. Today it's the same mandate. It hasn't, with Clinton it was the same mandate. With Bush it was the same mandate. But it is especially significant under Obama because this was the administration that actually bailed out the banks and that brought the banks into unprecedented prosperity, even as the rest of the nation suffered. And this is the administration that cleaned up the mess that started under Clinton. It all ties together. We need to watch and see how or if the Federal Reserve will emerge as a topic of discussion in terms of the economic crisis that we are in today. I want to thank you for your emails and your notes. They're very, very good. I like to get them because it keeps me on point. I want to thank you for that. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Leadstories, that's L-E-I-D, stories@gmail.com. And certainly drop me a line, if only to say hello. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. So stay tuned and have yourselves a good weekend. We'll join each other again on Monday. Keep your eyes peeled. I should say, keep tuned and attuned. Bye-bye.
You know those days when you don't feel good and everything looks so sad? When you get up from your bed, isn't your left foot not knowing what to do with your life?